One of the things that I have discovered over the years is that unless you are a delegate to General Convention, finding information about what's going to happen, what they're going to talk about, what the hot topics are, it's like pulling teeth. It's very, very difficult. That is especially true this year. The church is getting ready to gather for General Convention 2015 between June 25th and July 3rd in Salt Lake City. Now you're saying, isn't that a strange place to have an Episcopal convention? And because of the size of the convention, the number of lay and clergy delegates and all that sort of stuff, having facilities large enough that we'll be able to handle that size group limits kind of where they can meet. They are not meeting at the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And does anybody know why not? You have to be a Mormon. If you're not a Mormon, you can't go in. Okay? So, very, very restricted if you're not a Mormon. But anyway, so they're going to be actually meeting at the Salt Palace. This is going to be the first pretty much technologically run General Convention. The Blue Book, which is the book that the delegates that get, they're typically about that thick. And, of course, every delegate reads every page of every report. But they do get it months in advance. But this year, every delegate will be, when you register, you will be given an iPad. This is going to be almost a paperless convention. One of the reasons they're having it at the particular site that they are is that there will they will be able to have over 5,000 high-speed internet connections simultaneously. I mean, this is like state-of-the-art place, okay?
How many delegates go to this, approximately?
Approximately, okay, it's the number of dioceses, which in the United States and territories and all that stuff, I think it's 138 dioceses. Each diocese has typically 8 delegates to the House of Deputies. Every bishop, whether you're a retired, active, diocesan, suffragan, coadjutor, whatever, you got purple, you got a seat. Okay? So every bishop, should they desire to attend, is able to attend. Then you have all of the alternates, and many of the alternates, as in this diocese, we actually pay, I think, for 2 alternates to go, so that we have a full delegation at all times. And so you can pretty much figure deputized people at General Convention. A safe bet across the church would be maybe 20 people per diocese, because some dioceses are huge and have lots of retired bishops and all that stuff. You can pretty much figure there's going to be about 2,000 delegates and alternates, plus then you have all the media, you have all the people who are doing displays and booths at convention and all that sort of stuff. it basically takes about 5,000 people to pull off. They have to have space for that many people. Each delegate in almost all dioceses, each diocese pays, good evening Marilyn, each diocese pays the registration fees and expenses of the delegates. So just to give you an idea, this year it's $495 per person for registration. Then you have all the meals, the hotels, for typically 12 days. So it is a size plus transportation to Salt Lake. So it's a sizable thing, and this year is going to be a big year because we're electing a new presiding bishop. There are four people whose names have been put forward. And they are, I'm going to tell you a little bit about each of them. We have a local son, Dabney Smith, who was rector of one of the churches in Orlando until he was elected diocesan bishop of Southwest Florida. Dabney Smith is 61. He's been a bishop for 8 years. He graduated from Neshota House in 1987, and he has an earned doctorate, not an honorary doctorate. He has an earned doctorate from Seabury Western Episcopal. You know where Seabury Western is, I'm sure. So Dabney, I'm sorry? Okay. He's 61, and he was most immediately rector of Trinity Church in New Orleans before he was elected diocesan bishop in Southwest Florida. Moving north, Michael Curry, 62 years old. He is from the Diocese of North Carolina. I happen to know Michael, not because my son is there, but Michael and I go back about 30 years. He is the only candidate of color. Michael is black. Great man. The best preacher I know. He's a magnificent orator. He was rector of St. James in Baltimore before he was elected to be diocesan bishop of North Carolina. And he is the one, even though he's 62 years old, he has been a bishop for 15 years of a good, strong diocese, the Diocese of North Carolina. The Diocese of North Carolina has three different dioceses, so he has kind of the middle swath. There's Western North Carolina, North Carolina, and East Carolina. Michael, great guy. He went to Berkeley Divinity School, and Michael has an earned doctorate from Yale. Okay. The next one, we're going to go slightly west. The Thomas Breedenthal, he's 64. He's from the Diocese of Southern Ohio. Before he was elected bishop, he was the Dean of Religious Life and Contemporary Christianity at Princeton. So he was an academic. He graduated from CDSP, which is Church Divinity School of the Pacific in California. He's been a bishop for 8 years. And then moving into New England, we have Ian Douglas, who is the bishop diocesan of Connecticut. He is the youngest candidate. He's 56. He was a professor of mission and world Christianity at Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge before he was elected. He has only been a bishop for 5 years. He went to Harvard Divinity School and graduated in 83. And he has an earned PhD from Boston University in philosophy that he got in 1993. Okay, so the reason I wanted to give you just a little bio about all of them is we have people who, although they're all in a pretty small age group, 56 to 62, okay, remember the presiding bishop, as all clergy, have to resign at 72. So if we were to elect, let's say, Ian Douglas, who's 56, you could have the same presiding bishop for 16 years. Okay? Whereas if we elect the older person, which is Breedenthal, he's only going to be bishop diocesan, or presiding bishop, for 8 years. Okay? So, and there's two schools of thought. Okay? One school is maybe if we had somebody longer, there would be more greater stability. The other one is, if assuming we don't like them, they'll be out of there shortly. So that kind of depends on how you want to go with that. Are there any front runners? It simply depends on what part of the country you live in. They are predominantly from the East Coast. Okay. The no, that's not necessarily a good thing. Okay. One of the things that is there's actually a study that's been done, and this study was generated out of many people's desire to move the National Church headquarters out of New York. And they said, where is the geographical center of the Episcopal Church by population? Okay? And about 10 years ago, it was outside of St. Louis. It's now closer to Bowling Green, Kentucky. Okay, so when we look at the size of the churches, the size of the diocese, at some point you have to say, okay, what size diocese has this person administered? You know, the presiding bishop is pretty much an administrative position, as far as I'm concerned. And so if you have someone who, not that I'm ragging on Bishop Shorey, but presiding Bishop Shorey was never rector of a parish larger than a couple of hundred people. She never had a staff of more than a half a dozen people. She oversaw her budget responsibilities were much smaller, being in a diocese like Nevada. Okay, we have entire dioceses, okay, and I'm going to take a small one, just to give you an idea. The Diocese of North Dakota, if you were to take an average Sunday of all of the Episcopal churches in the Diocese of North Dakota, they don't have 895 people in church, in Episcopal churches, in the entire state of North Dakota during any given week. Their ASA, average Sunday attendance, is like 895. We have some dioceses that are smaller than that. We have many dioceses that have such a small budget that they're requesting missionary jurisdiction so they don't have to pay the going rate for a diocesan bishop. Okay? or they're actually looking at combining some smaller dioceses to make them more independent. Okay?
So, the start of the list you gave, two of them were academics, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Had they been parish?
All of them had been parish priests of various size congregations. The largest, the people who have the largest church experience are Dabney and Michael. Dabney, Trinity, New Orleans, has an average Sunday attendance of about 1,600, and St. James in Baltimore, probably 2,200. I mean, they're very large parishes. For example, the church Matt is in Charlotte, their parish budget is $4.5 million. Okay, the budget of the parish is twice that of the diocese. Okay. They have about 5,000 members, you know. Do the math. Okay. So anyway, hot things that are happening at General Convention. We're going to be electing a new presiding bishop. You may recall when they elected a pope, you know how they kind of sequester themselves and you wait for the white smoke. And it's not quite that dramatic, but close. Okay. What actually happens is everyone who is in the House of Bishops will leave Salt Palace, which is where the convention is, and they will go to the Episcopal Cathedral in Salt Lake City, which name is St. Mark's, and they will be sequestered there until they elect someone. At this juncture, there is no electronic communication allowed. Does everybody want to laugh now? No tweeting, no Facebook, no email. Yeah, everybody's going to abide by that. But basically, there will be, prayers. There'll be probably a worship service to begin the House of Bishops. They don't call it a conclave, but that's basically what it is. And they will elect one of these people. That word is sent to the House of Deputies that they have reached a conclusion, but they don't say who was elected. The House of Deputies, which is priests and laity, have to confer the election, not knowing who is elected. They send word back to the House of Bishops that they have conferred with and agree with the election, and then the House of Bishops comes back, they join the rest of the group, and then the announcement is made public. So if you hear on June 26th, which is when the election is going to be, oh, we've elected a presiding bishop, but we don't know who it is, you're kind of in between that period. The new presiding bishop will not speak or address or be a part of anything at this general convention until they are the preacher at the closing Eucharist. Okay? Bishop Shorey remains in office until, I think it's September 1st or November 1st. November 1st. And so her term will have been 9 years when she escalates out. Escalates is probably the wrong word. Time's out. Escapes. When we look at that issue, okay, I do want you to know there's a lot of politics. And some of the politicking is around the subject of openness.
try and drive us up from this morning.
And I can't hear myself think. One of the things that is being presented at this diocesan convention is probably the most radical departure from our understanding of general convention ever. Okay? First Diocesan Convention, 1785 in Philadelphia. It's basically happened on average about every 3 years. There were some years it was two, some years it was four, but starting in the early 1800s, it's every 3 years. There is a great coincidence that many of the people who were founders of the Episcopal Church were also founders of the United States government and the organizational structure that we have in our civil government. We have a House of Bishops, the Senate. We have the House of Deputies, which is the House of Representatives. Okay? We have what is called a bicameral system that provides checks and balances on both. At the last General Convention, there was a request that was made of a group of people who it did get passed, General Convention last time, and they said, we want to boldly go where no one has ever bothered to go and think about what the church would look like if we were starting over. If we did not have 200 plus years of history, and we want to reimagine what the church is going to look like. And there is a group, this group, a technical name is called the Task Force for Reimagining the Episcopal Church, or TREC for short. This idea has been surfacing for about the last 10 years, but it was pretty much geared around institutional reorganization. You know, we have a National Church Headquarters that has a $35 million mortgage, costs us $8.5 million a year to keep the building open, and gee, couldn't we sell that property, move to St. Louis, kind of more the geographical center with a big hub airport, and operate the church much cheaper, put all the extra money that would be made from the sale of the property into, you know, missions, endowments, whatever you want to do with it. And so there's been a move, a push by some people who want to reorganize the church to move the church center out of New York. That's not what this group is about. This group is about shifting, and I've given you 95% of the document. Wherever the handout that I gave you today, wherever you see three dots, there were superfluous, extraneous paragraphs that I didn't feel you needed. 12 pages is enough. But I didn't feel you needed that explanation to understand what's behind the document. But I want to kind of hit the highlights and for you to understand, hopefully, both sides of the issue. The first thing is that the document is suggesting doing away with the bicameral system in our church government. And there would be one body, House of Bishops, House of Deputies, laity, priests, bishops, deacons, all of that stuff, and they would sit in one body. Okay? There are several reasons for this. Okay? The first reason is that with the decline in size of the Episcopal Church institutionally, we don't need as big a structure as we currently have. Unfortunately, if you... I want you to kind of imagine a series of dominoes, okay? If the first domino falls, there's a whole lot of other things that are going to happen as a result of that one decision. The first thing is that the bishops and the House of Bishops are going to have significantly less power. Okay? And if you have, let's say, in this diocese, okay, you have a diocesan bishop who loves politics, Bishop Brewer, okay? He's chomping at the bit to go, you know, be in New York with a lot, or to see a lot of his new bishop friends, and he knows people all over the church, and he's an extreme extrovert, and of course he loves to go to stuff like that. Do you think Bishop Howe's going to General Convention? He didn't want to go when he was bishop. Okay, so we're not going to have, you know, a bunch of retired bishops and all that sort of stuff. So you're going to have one bishop, think of two senators. And then, in the proposal, you're going to have three ordained persons. They can be either deacons or priests, and three laity. So immediately, you've lost a vote. You're four lay people, as you currently have. It's currently four clergy and bishop, priests and deacons. All the bishops get to go, and four laity, and then equal numbers of alternates. Okay? So if you have a diocese like Central Florida, I just want to give you real numbers. Okay? Under this system, we would switch from four clergy delegates, four lay delegates, I'm not even going to count alternates, we would have potentially four retired bishops, and the diocesan bishop, so you would have 13 people. Under the new system, you have seven. Because if you're not the diocesan bishop, or actively employed as a bishop, if you're retired, you don't get to go. You don't get a vote. Okay? So, historically, when we look at how especially contentious votes have happened, sometimes the House of Bishops has been the group that is the tail wagging the dog. But that sensitivity has historically shown the right decisions. Let me just take, for example, in the Civil War era, I don't think I need to repeat U.S. history, you know, Civil War, North-South split, we don't talk, we fight, okay? Well, there was a split in the Episcopal Church during the Civil War period. There were two general conventions of the Episcopal Church in the South, one in 1861, one in 1864. And in 1867, when they came back as a United States and they called the roll, they included all the Southern states. But they'd included all the Southern states, even in 1861 and 1864. There was no big issue. There wasn't a big divide. It was kind of, okay, well, we're back. We're all one big happy family. Next. But it was the House of Bishops who saw to it that institutionally the church didn't go the way of the government. Okay? If we switch to a unicameral situation, the bishops lose a great deal of power. They lose a great deal of authority. and they lose a great deal of power when it comes to kind of holding the line on an issue. There are other times, and this one is going to be, I think, interesting for you. The House of Deputies was way ahead of the House of Bishops on the ordination to women votes. So even though the presiding bishop at the time, John Hines, and the majority of the House of Bishops were against the ordination of women, it was the House of Deputies, who were the laity and the priests, who said, full steam ahead, here we go, come on. And it was the House of Deputies that was kind of pushing the charge to bring the House of Bishops along. So when you study the kind of major contentious issues, whether it's about liturgy or worship or politics or whatever, that system has served us well, I think, over the last couple of hundred years. This does away with it completely. It also does away with the first six articles of the Constitution of the Episcopal Church. Okay? Now, I'm sure you've all read those recently, so you know exactly what those things entail. Okay? But this is a group, and let's look at some of the things. Anywhere in this document where you see anything in italics or anything underlined, that's me. That was something that, just a note to me, that I wanted to differentiate and call to your attention. I'm on page one. We've developed a set of recommended changes to the Constitution and canons. Okay, stop. Any change in Constitution and canons will have to be approved by two successive general conventions. So even if this gets voted through this time, okay, you're not going to start to see things automatically change because it has to pass again in 3 years. Set of recommended changes to the Constitution and canons, we believe, if adopted, will create a streamlined, unified, and more effective church-wide governance. Now, who that's voting against that's like, you know, against mom and apple pie. Who wouldn't want all of that? But this comes at a significant cost. And I don't mean dollars. It's urgently required for the church to respond to the needs of the convention that would call the church to prayer, study, and action around issues that include clergy preparation and financial support. And you're going, that's the number one issue? Okay, let me help you understand the background for that. If Matt Holcomb was a member of the Lutheran Church and he went to the Lutheran bishop and said, I want to go to seminary, and he goes through all the psychological and psychiatric and they say, yeah, go, you know, we encourage you, we support you, that's going to come with significant funding from the national church body. Our denomination does not support seminarians on the national church level. Individual dioceses do, individual congregations may help, but just to give you an example, we have a priest who went to church, he was he was a member of St. Gabriel's in Titusville. He and his family went to Sewanee for 3 years. He's returned to the diocese, and we were just dealing on diocesan board about an issue surrounding this individual. Okay? And this person left seminary with $67,000 in debt. That's average. Most of the people who were in Matt's class left between 80 and 100 living in New York. And y'all know how well the church pays to be able to eat up that stuff. Okay, so one of the major pushes coming out of this, and a big part is, remember, our clergy are aging. Most of them, as they're aging toward retirement, are leaving the church, don't want to do supply or work in the church. And so there's not a groundswell of young people coming in to the church. And most people feel the reason, one of the reasons there's not, is there's no financial stability right now for someone to come into the church and address that. My son Matt, just to give you an idea, when he got out of seminary in the Diocese of Pennsylvania, a condition of employment for the church he went to was that they pay his student loans the entire time he was there. So you need to understand, okay, this is a huge issue. You take a diocese like Pennsylvania, half of the clergy who are senior pastors in congregations are retired. Okay? Let me get the year. It was 31. Okay, in 1991, I received an invitation from the Church Pension Fund. The presiding bishop at the time wanted to get all of the clergy who were under 40 together and talk about the future of the church and, you know, what we can do about vocations and getting younger people into the church and what was your experience and all of this stuff. Okay, we're going to call everyone nationwide to New York, to the church center, and we're going to have a roundtable discussion of every Episcopal priest under 40 in the United States, 1991. Would anyone like to guess how many invitations were sent out?
Not as many as you expected.
It was under 60.
Right.
Wow. Under 60. Mm-hmm. That's the entire United States.
Wow.
Okay, so this issue of clergy preparation, okay, in the Diocese of Central Florida, if you wanted to be a deacon, it took you 4 years. If you want to be a priest, you could be a priest in 3. Bishop Brewer has cut that from 4 to 2. But with that cut also came a lot of the preparation and the schooling that took place through the Institute for Christian Studies. Diocesan viability and collaboration. When we look at the size of some of the dioceses, the number of churches, I think in the whole state of North Dakota, and I'm just picking on them because I know the bishop, there's only 14 congregations in the whole state. And there are only 4 self-supporting churches. You might need to think that maybe North Dakota and South Dakota need to become the Diocese of the Dakotas. Okay? So that's one of the...
You got to understand, too, that the population of that is about the same as Brevard County.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah.
600,000 to 700,000
people. Right. And how we're doing church and how we're funding church and how we're funding mission in remote geographical areas is ridiculously expensive. I remember meeting the youth pastor of the Diocese of Alaska. Okay, would anyone like to guess what the youth budget of the Diocese of Alaska is?
It's probably higher.
It's over $200,000.
Yeah, oil money.
But the majority of that is for his airplane license and fuel. because there's no way to get from one place to another. Okay, so how we do church, how we fund it. Okay, and finally, the use of the church's sacred buildings and spaces. I hope everyone realizes that the church owns lots of property. And I don't just mean churches. I mean rectories. I mean nursing homes. I mean hospitals. I mean colleges. Okay? So when we talk, okay, about property issues and assets, okay, I hope everyone's aware that the Diocese of South Carolina vacated, left the Episcopal Church, 38 congregations in the Diocese of South Carolina left the Episcopal Church and have gone over to one of the splinter Anglican bodies. It was a huge lawsuit that was brought forward. The Diocese of South Carolina prevailed. And in the judgment, of course it could be appealed at any time, but the judgment basically put, listen to the numbers, $500 million from the Diocese of South Carolina back in the hands of the people who left.
They won.
Okay, the people who left won. The continuing Diocese of South Carolina. Now, South Carolina has Upper South Carolina and South Carolina. So I'm not talking about Columbia, Spartanburg. That's Upper South Carolina. Diocese of South Carolina is more coastal South Carolina. That's the 38 churches that left and left with their $500 million in property and assets. That includes endowment funds. It includes, you know, all of those things. Now, there are some people who are livid that the National Church spent $20 million in litigation against itself. But I want you to know the reason they spent that money is to protect the assets of lots of congregations, and in some cases, whole dioceses, so that the continuing Episcopal Church could be funded and prosper. Okay, so there's two sides of the coin. Yeah, you pay for it, but it's not yours. Okay? Everybody knows the title of our property isn't in our safe. It's in Orlando on Robinson Avenue. I'm sorry?
This property is one of the most valuable pieces of church property.
Wait a minute, this one that we're on?
Yeah. That's what I was told.
I think it's very valuable. I don't know that as I think about the cost per square foot of the land that the Cathedral of St. Luke is on in downtown Orlando, I can think of other places that have much larger acreage. I think this is a very valuable piece of property. But I think one of the things that differentiates St. David's from many of the other beach congregations is healthy reserves. Okay. Even after the building is all done and finished and all that sort of stuff, there's still going to be a sizable endowment left. And after we spend the amount of money we're spending, the likelihood that the trustees are going to be receptive to any other requests from the endowment is pretty slim, as I would expect. Many of the local congregations, as I think about those congregations that are within 50 miles of us, Holy Trinity in Melbourne has sizable resources. We would probably be next. St. Mark's in Cocoa, less than half after we're finished. St. Gabriel's less than half of that. So you get a tight economy, a catastrophic event, whatever. The ability of churches to rebound after a significant financial collapse, difficult. This group is presenting this unicameral body request to convention, and they say there are three basic practices that help to animate the early Christian movement. And in this document, and you'll see when you read it at length if you're interested, the difference between institution and movement. Okay? I have a basically different understanding of movement and institution than is used in this document. For me, the movement has always come first, and the institution grows up as dictated by the movement to define and channel the movement forward. Okay? What this document is actually saying is we kind of need to forget we're an institution and go back and realize we're a movement, and then we'll figure it out as we go. We'll re-become a different institutional structure. What we need to do is follow Jesus together. We need to go into our neighborhoods, and we need to travel lightly. Explain what they mean by that. Obviously, refocusing our message on the gospel message, which hopefully is centered on the person of Jesus and his atoning death and resurrection. Go into our local communities and say, basically, unless you're making a difference in your neighborhood, it doesn't matter what difference you're making outside of your neighborhood. You are your parish for a reason, and you need to deal with the issues in your community. The third, travel lightly, as is understood in this document, basically is we need to let go of the baggage. And that baggage is often, throughout this document, people who don't think like you, then, I think. So it's not, you know, we need to divest ourselves of our buildings, we need to do something like that. This program that's being presented, which as I understand it from our delegates, will either be voted up or down. It's not up for modification of sections. Resolve, the House of Bishops, the House of Deputies, concurring that the 78th General Convention adopt a unicameral modern of governance as outlined in Amendments 1, Section 1 through 6 of the Constitution, as proposed in Trek's final report. Be it further resolved that the bishops of the Episcopal Church create, nurture, and develop a culture of collaboration that results in new structures, partnerships, and practices on the interpersonal, group, and organizational levels, measurable, tangible outcomes of performance, standards of accountability, reporting and mutual ministry reviews at all levels, bishops, clergy, diocesan bodies, frank discussion on the number and size of our diocese and whether change is needed, and report their progress to each succeeding general convention. Yay. I can hardly wait. That just really excites me. What they're looking for here, and we see this happening on the organic level in certain dioceses. Okay? For those of you who have never been involved in kind of the hiring political side of the church, once a congregation hires a clergy person, okay, pretty much from day one, it's going to cost you a bucket load of money to get rid of them if you don't like them.
if you don't think this is going to work, or this isn't working out, or, you know, it's not a good fit, or whatever, it's going to cost you something. Okay? If that clergy person has been there a year, it's going to cost you a whole lot more. Okay? Most dioceses have reviews now of clergy before the 1 year, so they can be out of there before the 1 year anniversary clock ticks. So you're in a congregation and, you know, duly employed, all that sort of stuff. Okay. What's happening in the church these days is, for people like me, you know, I was told, and the canons of the church, that I came into the church, from day one, you have tenure, you don't need to worry about it. The canons still say that, but you don't. It's all now, everything up is now to interpretation. And it's in terms of interpretation for how the bishop interprets it. So you can see something's going on in the local or diocesan level. You may not like it. You appeal to the bishop. He doesn't agree with you. You have no appeal. You're done. You know, you can't appeal to the presiding bishop. They don't have any authority over the local bishop. Okay? And so what this basically is saying is we're going to adopt this wonderful new spirit of collegiality.
Really?
We can't get bishops 20 miles away to talk to us. 40 miles away. Really? And we're just going to snap our fingers and create a resolution at diocesan convention and everybody's going to be happy and agree? I mean, we have bishops that boycott the House of Bishops because they've been treated so poorly. In a perfect world, this would be nice. I just don't know how they're going to bring it about. Yeah.
I don't want to be argumentative, but after that sentence which starts, create, nurture, develop, yada, 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 which the entire sentence says nothing, how did we get from that to the... from the statement, create a streamlined, unified, more effective church-like governance structure, you said that's like mom and apple pie. How do we agree on what that is? I mean, being a vestry member, those of us on the vestry can argue over something we agree about for about an hour.
If you're a Republican and can figure out who to vote for this time, what you're basically saying is, I want smaller government. If you're a Democrat, regardless of who you vote for, you know, you're okay with government involvement and somewhat intrusion into people's lives and freedoms. Right? That's how I mean, that's a gross overstatement of the difference between Republicans and Democrats. There are those who believe that the church structure is fine. It's not the structure that needs to be tweaked. It's the rest of the church that needs to be treated. But there are those who feel that if we just fix the structure, then everything else will follow. Okay? That's what's behind this document.
So in other words, this is on page one, slightly below halfway. We believe this adopted will create streamline, yada, yada. That's essentially a bunch of people saying, we don't like it the way it is, we'll change it, we'll figure out how we're going to do it later. And what's going to change later?
Vote for Obamacare, and then we'll give you the document that has 2,800 pages to explain its rules. Okay. Now, I say that fairly tongue-in-cheek, okay, in that as we look at what's driving this, okay, one of the issues that's driving this is economics. Let's just be really clear. Okay. General Convention has become an incredibly expensive, burdensome thing. And is there a way that we could do it in less than 2 weeks at thousands of dollars per delegate for rooms and hotel and travel and all that sort of stuff? Okay, because actually, let's be really clear, if you're a blue-collar person, you can't run through convention delegate. If your boss going to let you off for 2 weeks to go to a church convention? I don't think so. Okay. If you're affluent, you can go. If you're a clergy, you can convince the vestry it's part of your job. Okay. But let me just say that, you know, streamline general convention, yeah. Maybe if we didn't have 8,000 resolutions about everything under the sun and got back to being a church, we might not need a 2-week convention. Okay? But, you know, I think that there are ways and means that we can streamline it without robbing either the House of Bishops or House of Deputies of some of the power and authority that they have. Notice, next resolve, task force on the episcopacy be appointed by the presiding officers composed of 4 bishops, 4 clergy, 4 laypersons. Task force will explore the practice and particular gifts, life experience, expertise, social diversity required by the episcopacy, recommending to General Convention a new process for discernment, formation, search, and election of bishops in the Episcopal Church. We had a process. We've just gone through a process to find Bishop Brewer 3 years ago. Some of us think that process worked really well. We had local sons. We had, we did have a local daughter in that race. We decided in this diocese to go with the oldest candidate. Bishop Brewer was the oldest. And we went with the guy who wasn't local, but had been a local son years ago. So he has knowledge of Central Florida. But he hadn't had recent experience. He had a good reputation in the national church. He was conservative enough to be elected, but not so conservative that he would alienate the more liberal side of the church. And I think Bishop Brewer's done a fabulous job keeping those two ends in tension, which I think is a part of the job of the bishop. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a small group of people, and let's be very clear, and in just a minute you're going to see this recommends the executive committee be dropped from 100 to 38. Okay? Now, it might sound crazy that you have 100 people, but not if you understand that 2 of them come from every state. And the executive committee is typically appointed, not so much elected. Okay? So again, trying to get fairness, representation from everybody. Okay? And the executive committee works between general conventions. They only meet once a quarter. Again, very expensive. But can we reduce it down? What this resolution is basically saying is there's going to become a unified standard of discernment and searching for bishops from diocese to diocese. And let's be very clear. If you are looking for a bishop in the Diocese of New York or Connecticut or North Carolina, even, all large dioceses, the process that you go through is very different than if you're trying to find a bishop of North Dakota. Okay? If you're looking for a bishop in North Dakota, you're looking for somebody who will move there. Okay? You're also looking for someone, and let's be very clear, okay? What was it? Up until 1941, the presiding bishop was a standing bishop in his or her own diocese. They did the presiding bishop's job on top of their diocesan bishop job. Now the diocesan bishop and the presiding bishop job have no connection. When you're elected presiding bishop, you have to resign your diocesan bishop job. So again, do we want one format to do everybody?
diocesan assessment percentage be lowered while making it canonically mandatory. I hope everyone realizes that out of every dollar that you give to St. David's, a portion of that money goes to the Episcopal Church national headquarters. It becomes a part of our domestic and foreign missionary apportionment. It helps fund work in schools, many of the social programs. I just want you to know, in this diocese, okay, the Diocese of Central Florida, those congregations who so wish, give 10% of their diocesan pledge to the National Church. You have been able to opt out of that, and currently over half of our congregations do. I want to go back 3 years and tell you that, 5 years, St. David's in Cocoa Beach and St. Stephen's in Lakeland, where I was, were two of the only 10 congregations in the diocese out of 87, who sent $1 to the National Church. The National Church requests an assessment of 18%. Those of us who gave 10, and those who didn't give, their giving had to be deferred to other groups. You couldn't just say, we're not going to give, we're going to keep the money. So 10% goes to the diocese, and of that, 10% went to the Appalachian People's Service Organization, it went to literacy programs, it went to the Diocese of Honduras, our companion diocese. I mean, it did lots of good work, but it was deferred money, didn't go to the National Church. What this is now saying is there will be a mandatory assessment. They're going to lower the percentage, they don't say to what, but then everybody's going to have to do it. I do want you to know that we have some dioceses who give in the 2 and 3% category. And I'm not talking North Dakota. I'm talking about large dioceses. Okay? So just because you send money or don't send money says things. But I can tell you, we have many congregations in this diocese who have taken Episcopal off the sign out front. They now say Anglican. I think that's horrible. We have many congregations that no longer pray for the presiding bishop because they don't agree with her. I don't get that either. We're an Episcopal church. We're part of a... You know, pardon my bluntness, but we're part of a franchise. And there's a part of the Episcopal Church, okay, that because I pay my money both to this congregation and a part of my pledge goes to the National Church, I feel if there's something going on I don't like, I can have a voice. Because I sent money behind that voice. You know, people who say, I'm going to just withhold my pledge, and that'll make a statement. Really? Talk to any rector and ask how much they listen to people who don't ever support the church, either financially or by their presence, or, you know, if you just kind of have somebody, oh, yeah, I'm a member of that church, and you never see them, and they don't participate, they don't give. Well, you know, and then they, you know, show up and turn cartwheels because you painted the door red. You think I'm going to listen to them? Although I would love red doors. Resolve the House. Canterbury red, of course. Resolve the House of Bishop, House of Deputies, that sections 1 through 6 of the Constitution be stricken in their entirety and replaced with, okay, here we're going to meet together as one body, and this is where you start to see the dissolution of the structure. Okay? And they've tried to think of a lot of stuff. Bishop, clerical, and lay may meet and deliberate separately, except as the Constitution, canon, or rule of order may otherwise provide. On any matters requiring a vote, any order may choose to deliberate and or vote separately. Oftentimes in diocesan or national church elections or votes or whatever, the canons of the church are set up so that you can see, and I'll give you my prejudice, which way the Spirit is blowing. Okay? For example, Bishop Brewer was elected on the, I believe, third or fourth ballot. And after ballot one, it was very clear that the House of the clergy were strongly in favor of two particular candidates. But the laity were way out ahead for Bishop Brewer. I mean, way out ahead. And one of the favorite sons gets dropped off each successive ballot, or daughter. And lo and behold, and all of a sudden you say, oh, Bishop Brewer's rallying on vote two. Okay? And then vote three or four, whichever one he was elected, oh, it's a landslide. You know, yeah, we see how the Spirit moved. Or the political machine moved. Okay? All I'm saying to you is that system, okay, has both caused elections and prevented elections. I have been to Episcopal elections that went to the 13th or 14th ballot. We had to come back the next day. Okay? And some of the people that you thought were shoo-ins, things came out in the caucusing that you learned that you decided you didn't want. Under this section, only diocesan bishops would have vote. Section 4 basically says that every diocese has the same representation. Every diocese has three clergy, bishops or priests or deacons, three laity, diocesan bishop, and any employed bishops get a vote. Okay? So let me ask you a question in terms of equity. If you represent a diocese with fewer than 1,000 communicants in church on Sunday, should you be listened to with as much voice and authority as someone who has 64,000 people in church on Sunday? Okay, a part of the reason in our bicameral government we have Senate. Every state gets two votes, regardless of the issue. Legislature, the House of Representatives, is based on population. So if you're in New York, California, whatever, you're going to get a lot more votes. And by having a bicameral situation, you have to get it passed both. Now, we don't have an executive committee like the Pope or, you know, that we have to worry about that next level. All you have to do is pass both houses. So the big issue is, are the bishops going to be willing to give up some of their power and authority? And is the church going to buy this? I don't know. Anybody have any questions? Yeah, Joy?
Well, I'm just reading at the last sentence in section 1, which is little bit of a spin. In all deliberations, freedom of debate shall be allowed, subject to such rules of order as may be adopted to assure fairness. In other words, there will be no freedom of debate.
And
that's going to be bulldozed right into you. Will debate what we believe in.
And there's typically not now. Typically, depending on the number of people who are standing at the microphone, most people are given 3 minutes. You might have a collection of people all go up and they say, I will give my 3 minutes to this. You know, and they can go on. There's no filibustering at General Convention.
How much shouting down?
It's been less in recent years. There have been years when it's been pretty vocal. I can tell you, I've never wanted to be a General Convention deputy. I don't want to be a diocesan clergy deputy. I go to convention. I think it's an important thing to do. I was elected to the diocesan board because I wanted to serve on the diocesan board. And I believe that being on the board, I have made a difference. I don't feel when I go to convention, I make a difference. Okay? It's a much smaller group. I'm happy to serve in that way. Under section 4, in addition, the church in each diocese that's been admitted to union with the General Convention, each area mission established as provided, shall be entitled to representation by 3 ordained priests or deacons, clergy canonically resident of the diocese, and not more than 3 lay persons confirmed adult communicants of this church. Okay? One of the great misconceptions is, this is going to really streamline the process. Well, one of the things it's going to do is it's going to cut out about half of the number of bishops. Okay? The other thing is it's going to do in terms of the laity is you're only saving 1 clergy vote and 1 lay vote. So you're not significantly adjusting. What you're really doing is losing your representation by 4. But before you get all excited about that, let's be very clear. Let's say we have at this table our deputation. Okay, Jim, you and Joy are a part of this. Here are our delegates. We have 4 clergy and we have 4 laity. Okay? When it comes time to the vote, okay, we get 1 vote. You get 1 vote. If it's 2-2, our vote is recorded as 0. If it's 3-1, it's recorded as 1 for the 3 side. Okay? So, if all of a sudden you have only 3 delegates and your vote counts as 1, every vote's going to count, but it's going to count less. You'll have a third of a vote, okay? But there's a greater likelihood mathematically that that can get you in trouble. So, when you look at, think the number that things pass by at convention, don't look for 1,200 votes for this. No, it's like 165 for 184 against or something like that. A couple of other things about this. Voting by order should not be required. Okay, we have some issues in the canons that are required voting by orders. We want to know how the clergy vote and how the bishops vote. That would all be gone. At the General Convention, a majority of vote of those deputies present. Okay? It's 10 o'clock at night. You've done today. You've done today. You're a majority. You can be a majority of 1.
I'm watching forensic files.
Okay. But I just want to say now it's a majority vote of the delegation. So if you only have 1 or 2 people there, you don't have a majority. You have to have 3 people there to have a majority. Okay?
Where now does everybody have a vote? Is that?
Everybody has a quarter of a vote. Okay? So if you vote 3 or you vote 4, you get 1 vote. If you vote 1 or you vote 2, you don't get a vote. Basically, you get a no vote.
So now if everybody is taking a break or Benny Bob, they don't have a quorum, they don't get their votes don't get counted?
No.
Well, at the general convention, a majority vote of those deputies present, even though less than a quorum may adjourn. I don't understand.
Okay. Let's say it's day 7 of convention. It's such a wonderful time to visit Salt Lake in end of June. Has anybody been to St. Paul?
It's hot there.
It's hot.
It's hot there.
Okay.
It's beautiful. Okay. But I got news for you. Okay. Somebody better be dragging the people from Alaska around Salt Lake. They're not going to make it. Okay. And the people from North Dakota, they haven't been around weather like that, okay? Day 7, it's 9 o'clock at night, and it can go on to 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night.
That's cool.
Okay?
I'm at the bar.
after 10, right? Okay. And you don't have a quorum? No problem. We can still vote. A quorum is going to become a quorum of whoever's present. Okay? And so, okay, it's just like now. Okay? One of the other things that is happening on the internet is you're starting to see a posting of people's names who are going to be elected bishop and probably consecrated bishop at General Convention. There was one in particularly, I wrote her name down, Okay, this is the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania. Audrey Scanlon has received a required majority of consents.
Okay, so I don't know who this woman is. She was elected. She's received the required number of consents. And everybody goes, okay, yay, you know, you can consecrate our bishop now. There is a canon that says if you are elected within 3 months of General Convention, instead of 3/4 of the number of dioceses that you get consent, you only need half plus one. Now, that canon was made back in the 1800s when mail took months. You're going to send a letter out to every bishop, you know, oh, we elected so-and-so. Will your standing committee and commission on ministry consent to the election? Well, you don't have a clue who this person is. Sure, what the heck. Okay. It might take 2 months to get the letter back. So they said, you know, if we get a majority of consents by somebody who's elected really close to General Convention, then while we're all together, we can go ahead and do it. And if you recall, I'm not going to talk about the politics of Bishop Robinson in New Hampshire, but he was elected in that 3-month period. So the number of consents required of the standing committees was significantly less. It was 50 as opposed to 75. And so that was one of the things that some people objected to. But it was fully in line with the canons of the church. Court.
You mentioned very early on that everything's going to be electronic. Everybody will have their own little voting device in their position. Whether they're sitting there, or whether they're in their room, or whether they're
at the bar,
they could be punching it in, just like they have to know.
And I got news for you. In case you haven't noticed, we have a grain of the church. And if you think it's not going to be a nightmare of people who are handed an iPad and they want to know where the pen is.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I can tell you, I love Gwen Martin to death. Okay. I am her technical guru person. She left her iPad charger in Tampa when she went to visit her niece. And she came over and she said, you have an extra one? Yeah, sure, no problem. Here. Okay, and I handed it to her. And she handed me her iPad and said, do you know how to put this on? Sure, well, I'm happy to do that. Okay. Think of the number of delegates who, all of their worship bulletins, everything is coming up on their iPad.
I'm glad I'm...
Those of us who don't use that. I mean, it took me almost a jet evening to figure out how to print two lines on the computer in the laboratory, in the office here, just to say something was, you know, the bathroom was closed or something.
Right. Okay. One of the other things that's hotly going to be debated on the floor is you'll notice... The standing committees of each diocese create standards for intervention and endowment spending policies. Okay? Now, I hope you all realize we have an endowment here. The endowment is governed by an endowment trust agreement that was both passed by the vestry and recorded in the civil courts. I mean, it is a binding legal agreement. It's not just a church document. Okay? We have additional bylaws that the vestry have passed that govern the use and exercise and oversight of that endowment. And I am going to be working with the endowments committee as we finish this building program to... tighten up some of the loose ends that we realize exist. I don't want the endowment policy to be less restrictive. I want it to be more restrictive. Okay? And we need to do that to protect the endowment because future clergy might not view it the way I do. Okay? And you will see as we move down the line, that's coming. But do we want the diocese to step in and tell us what the endowment policies? Okay, I'm sure that would go over really well at Trinity Wall Street, who have a slightly different perspective on endowments. And I don't know that they want to hear a whole lot from the standing committee about that.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
The only thing good about that is they could give advice, but not give specific direction and follow it as I give it.
The Episcopal Church Foundation and the Diocesan Board in almost every diocese have endowment policies to guide and govern, okay, that are not restrictive or intrusive.
Right.
That's not where this is going.
Okay.
I want you to read through the lines here, and I'm going to give you my prejudice. I know you're very surprised at that. I don't know what this word means. As the church accelerates,
speeds up,
what we see as an urgent process of reimagination and renewal, we believe that it must also renew its governance structures. But we've already said we're going to modify the governance structures up front before the change happens. The governance model that may have served us well in one historic period does not seem to serve us as well today. I would not disagree with that. For many Episcopalians and prospective Episcopalians who really don't give a care about our structure, our decision-making processes are often opaque, ineffective, or both, making it difficult for the church to make the tough trade-offs or pursue the bold new directions that are demanded of us today.
Really?
I can tell you
I can tell you that one of the hotly debated, frustrated, litigated arguments in the church was the use of the executive committee to spend $20 million on legal fees to sue the church, to sue itself. And while it was trying to protect hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, the accounting for that money has been requested by no fewer than five dioceses, and it has yet to come forward. So, you know, we want to talk about openness and transparency and all that. Well, yeah, we're happy to do it as long as the same rules apply to everybody. But this, I would agree that they're often opaque. Let me give you a completely inconsequential thing that is not going to delay the second coming of Christ more than a few seconds. We were talking at Diocesan Board several months ago, and, you know, we said, you know, the National Church and General Convention, all that stuff, and our Diocesan Council keep passing all these resolutions, like, you know, on this Sunday would you take up an offering for the Diocese of Honduras, and on this Sunday would you take up an offering for Camp Wayman, and on this Sunday would you take up an offering for Canterbury. You know, and it's kind of like they said, okay, so Good Friday goes to the Episcopal Church in Jerusalem, and, you know, I know what some of the biggies are. Can I get a calendar somewhere of all of these resolutions that have been passed by General Convention? So I know, okay, so I was commissioned by the board to contact people at the National Church Center, which has over 400 employees. Could somebody direct me to a website or a calendar or something that tells me what all these days are? No. Okay. But we passed the resolution, okay? Request coming out of General Convention, focus more deeply on local missions and community building. I think that's one of the things that the Outreach Committee has really done a stellar job in getting us involved in local missions here. Make better decisions more effectively, allocate resources more wisely, make more space for innovation that emerges from all parts of the church. Okay? There's a receptivity that I love. There's just some specifics that are woefully missing. So, you know, is this going to pass? I don't know if this is going to pass. I don't hear a huge groundswell of support, but it's the only thing on the table. Okay? It's not like there's an alternative recommendation for this. One of the, that's all I want to talk about, this document, but I wanted to give it to you so you could read. If you have any questions, I can deal with those on Sunday or next week. Just talk to you about a couple of other things. One of the things that is going to be coming before General Convention is encouraging every congregation to reduce their carbon footprint. To not use as many disposables and, you know, things like that. That's coming about. They're encouraging every congregation to actively embrace innovative software and technology, using media whenever possible. There, I told you about the goal to make General Convention as paperless as possible. It's going to be introduced as this is the convention of screens. So that'll be very interesting. Everything will be available on laptops, tablets, smartphones, and video monitors.
Do we have somebody going to those conventions?
We have several delegates from the Diocese of Central Florida. From this congregation, no, we do not. Okay. One of the other things that's going to be talked about, I don't know if anything legislatively is going to come out of it, but I hope everyone realizes we have five dioceses in the United States that have left the Episcopal Church. These would be the Diocese of Pittsburgh, Quincy, which is in Illinois, Fort Worth, South Carolina, and there's one more. Northern Indiana. And hold that thought. Okay. And the Diocese of Albany, Dallas, Albany, New York, Dallas, Texas, Springfield, Ohio, Central Florida, which is us, and the Diocese of Rio Grande are still in the Episcopal Church, but we are a part of a 10 diocese group that is called the Communion Network Partner, Anglican Communion Network Partners. The five of us, of which Central Florida is, has tried to remain faithful to the Episcopal Church, but they're also reaching out to the Archbishop of Canterbury. They want to make sure that when and if the national church is put under any kind of censure in the Anglican Communion, that there will still be a linkage between our diocese and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Bishop Brewer has made it crystal clear, we're not leaving the Episcopal Church. When you come into this diocese, you have to sign a document that says you're not going to take your congregation nor work to alienate your people from the Episcopal Church. And you have to sign that in blood, which I think is good. Because we had clergy who came into the diocese for the sole purpose of taking their congregation out and going to ACNA or AMIA or the Southern Cone or the Global South or Nigeria or Uganda or, you know, somewhere else, okay? And as many, you know, long-standing historic churches, Truro Church, Falls Church, Christ Church Plano, Texas, these are enormous churches that had left, and they have left the Episcopal Church and have allied with another body. There are those in the church who feel that anyone who's a part of the Communion Network partners are traitors, and they need to be kicked out. Obviously, I'm not one of them. I'm going to die a faithful Episcopalian. I'm going to die without becoming cynical about the church. I'm very hopeful not only for our congregation, but for the Episcopal Church. I still think we have a message that we need to proclaim. I think we need to do it better, smarter, wiser, healthier. But I think there is a future for the Episcopal Church. I love what Winston Churchill said, which is the Episcopal Church is the great sleeping giant, that if it ever wakes up, the world needs to watch out. And I agree with that. But I do want you to know that there are some kind of major political rifts. And whereas at one time we prayed for all sorts and conditions of men and women, there seem to be boundaries that are getting drawn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I for one, and I can tell you, we've had people who have come and visited the church, and within like 5 minutes, you know, well, what's your position on this? What's your position on that? You know, and I'm going, you know, I don't know that you're really going to be happy here. Because we don't like to fight. You know? If you're for this or anti this, okay, next. Okay. Let's just make sure we're for the Lord. Yeah.
Aren't a lot of those boundaries being softened and changing and kind of reevaluating, if you will?
I think in some ways they are softening, but they're not softening.
Not returning.
Healthily. Yeah. I think they're softening by death. I mean, people are just getting old and tired and don't want to fight anymore. Some people. Some people, they're just over. You know, they don't want to hear about it. My friend that was here visiting today is from Sawtee, Georgia. Up in the North Georgia Mountains. Okay? And I said, what do your people think about General Convention? Is that coming up soon? I said, you're on sabbatical. You're not thinking about that kind of stuff. But, and he said, do your people talk about it? I said, no. Okay? But I want them to at least know what's happening. Okay? Because this is our church. And, you know, I will say that our delegates are very responsive. If you have strong feelings one way or another, you can email them, call them, talk to them before they leave in the next month, or when they come back, they are in this diocese. Remember, you're a deputy. You're not a delegate. I call them delegates, but you're actually a deputy. And the difference between a delegate and a deputy is you can vote any way you want. If you're a deputy. If you're a delegate, you're typically sent with a voting agenda that you're held responsible to. So you can elect who you feel are the most conservative of people, and they can vote liberal on every issue, and there's not a word you can say. But in this diocese, records are kept. Now, with everything on iPads, I'm sure it'll all be electronically available. You can see what everybody votes on every issue. And, you know, if they don't vote the way you want, gee, next time they run, you won't elect them. What is going to happen is during the course of General Convention, there will be a news feed, live news feed every day, the bishop does. We'll make that available on the website, so if you want to hear what happened. He typically does those about 10 o'clock at night, and Joe Toma gets them out, posts them on the link, and we'll link to that. So if you want to know what's going on in General Convention, there'll be a daily video report that's done either by the bishop or Joe Toma or one of our delegation. So you will know what happens. And at the end of General Convention, there'll be a listing in the FYI of the major legislation that passes, so you know kind of where we're going from here. Okay? So don't lose any sleep over it. What's that?
You asked a question.
Well, you kind of answered. Kind of.
And what was that? Nobody knows. Okay. June 26th through July 3rd. June 25th. Please keep our delegates, our bishop, in your prayers for safe travel, for guidance, for a little bit of peace in the midst of a hectic 10 or 12 day schedule. And we'll keep you up to snuff what's happening.